This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here today at BT Adastral Park near Ipswich, and I'm talking with Kevin Woolard.
Hello, Ian. I'm the Ops Director here at Adastral Park. I often tell people I have the second best job in BT. I get to operate Adastral Park, so to making sure that all the users here at the park, that's BT and the other 96 companies in the high-tech cluster that we've been building, are getting what they need and that the park is working for them. So that's a fabulously engaging job. And I'm also the Ops Director for BT's own research and innovation activity. So that's really engaging with the technology that's changing our business. And so I reckon that I have one of the best jobs in the business.
You have this huge site, which is basically BT's biggest toy box and a brains trust behind it. How hard is it just keeping that driving forward without getting lost in projects from people who think it's cool rather than fiscally productive?
Oh, well, to be honest, that is not an issue. We're pretty task-focused. Even in our innovation activity, we are innovating to a purpose. We know why we're doing things. So we have the outcome in mind before we start. So that's at the innovation end, and that's whether we're out and about scouting for new technology, and we scout globally. So we've got people out in California and Silicon Valley. We look in Israel. We have people in China. We look in India. So we are out around the planet looking. Or whether it's part of our research program, which we build in a deliberate way with the business, and we'll go out and connect to all of BT's lines of business to find out what are the problems that are challenging them, maybe not just today, but what do they foresee their problems being, and we build a research program that will allow those problems to be solved. So from the most innovative end of the business right through, so if you then look at the more practical end, so the delivery of, say, BT Sport, which we did from the park here, we woke up one morning to discover BT was a sports right owner, and we had a very short period of time to deploy the technology for a seamless launch of that service as part of our portfolio. So we are pretty task-focused. So keeping it on the tracks is not normally the problem.
You have quite a sophisticated set of test labs here. Everything you roll out, you test here, but you test on a national basis by being able to scale up your own internal test systems. How expensive is that? I've heard figures bandied around of it being £500 million worth of equipment.
Yes, that's a figure we use. We have a number of other little models. We also say there's enough kit here to run Belgium. Why you'd want to run Belgium from here, I don't know. But it's really just a way of conveying the fact that we take it very seriously. And, of course, we've been doing it for as long as there's been a company. And BT goes back to 1847, to the Electric Telegraph Company. We can actually trace our lineage back to the first telco on the planet. We've always tested against a standard reference model for our networks. As they've evolved, so have the test network models. And of course, as we retire technology, we can retire the models as well. But actually retiring things in the telecoms business takes a long time, so a lot of the kit is still over in our test model. And we've got a very large building over at the back of the site containing just about everything we've ever done, and we test against it on a pretty rigorous basis.
That's quite important, because I come from a military background. I've worked inside part of the government telecommunication systems in the past, and you find systems there that were installed in the 40s, 50s, 60s. How much of a challenge is that as a commercial company to have to support 40, 50, 80 years worth of technology?
Clearly that is, and you know, the last 3 years or 4 years we've been on a program of trying to retire niche and replaceable technology rather than maintaining forever, you know, a small, tiny niche service that's being provided for one application only. We have been actively trying to retire platforms and systems so that we can simplify the estate, partly because it makes the estate more reliable, it gives a much cleaner choice to our customers, it makes it easier to manage, and it reduces costs, makes the business more efficient. So we have been on that program. Having said that, there are services like the PSTN that are running off the System X exchanges, which is technology that was developed jointly between BT and industry. So a lot of the work was done here, and a lot of the early systems were put into our test models, and some of them are still there. We have yet to get round to fully retiring that particular set of technology. We are working on it, of course.
You mentioned BT Sport and waking up one morning and finding you suddenly had to become a sports broadcaster and scaling a network. What is the average time between coming up with a technology you think that there's a real commercial requirement for and being able to not just run through your test labs, but then move into the field?
It is quite a varied answer on that one. There is no really good metric that says it's 6 months, it's a year, it's 2 months. Pace is the thing that we talk about a lot. We want things done quickly. We work in an industry where things don't stand still for very long, and the competition's quite active in pretty much every area. Depends on the scale of the change, and it depends on the process we have to go through to take an idea from concept through to deployment. A nice example might be something like, say, G.fast, which is the ultra-fast broadband over copper product that we are currently trialing in field. That's got a journey of, and it really depends where you consider that its journey starts. We rather think that it's been about 3 years from the point that we projected the fact that we could do something different over copper that would be instrumental in upping the rates that we could deploy. But a large portion of the delay has been around getting it standardized, because if you don't work with standards, you can't take the supply community with you because they won't build for a special. And if you want to do something that the rest of the world doesn't understand, you're starting from some way back. So you've got the whole process of persuading the industry that this is a really cool idea, and that's a commercial discussion with your oppos in the industry. Once you've done that, you've then got to actually write the standards, get them ratified, get the suppliers to build, get the suppliers to build at the right scale, get the field trials done, get the commercials worked out, and then you've got a product. So with the best will in the world, big network interventions like that are never going to be fast.
Part of your problem is you have such a massive estate of old stuff in the ground. How much does that inhibit the new inventions that come along that you want to deploy, but actually you can't because the amount of time and cost and effort required to change some of the underlying infrastructure almost stops you?
I would say that's a bit of a mixed bag. If you look at things like optical fibre, which has been in the ground since the mid-80s, and we're very proud because we were involved in the pioneering of single-mode optical fibre. We didn't invent it. It was invented by Charles Kao. He took it around the world as an idea, and the guys here at the labs thought it was a cool idea. The rest of the world thought it was slightly bonkers, I think. We spent a fair portion of the late 70s, early 80s working out just exactly how you could manufacture and handle, deploy, and manage this stuff. That's been in the ground ever since, and the same fibres that were in the ground we're now running terabit services over, bearing in mind it was originally designed to take 140 megabits, which at the time sounded like a lot and now sounds a bit like a consumer product. But the same fibre is sitting there running, well, we've got one service running at 2 terabits. We think the fibres will support up to 40 terabits, so they're not really causing us a problem. We think that's a gift that carries on giving. With copper, well, I've mentioned G.fast already. The view on copper is that largely the copper network is good for some impressive speeds. We've talked about 300 megs to the consumer from the cabinets. That's, of course, it's all length of copper cable dependent, because as you know, it's all radio over copper, which degrades with length. We think we can get good service out in the region of 300 megs. That's a pretty decent speed from pretty ancient copper in some places. So it's not such a huge problem for us. There's always going to be one or two locations where the copper's not good, or it's faulty, or it's mixed infrastructure that we'd have to do something about. But generally not a problem.
You mentioned you're at the center of a huge innovation hub with a lot of companies coming in. How much of that innovation from those companies ends up being jointly deployed by yourself and them? How much is it an opportunity for them to learn from you and then go off and build a business model?
So the clusters, it has three types of businesses in the cluster. There's the telco supply industry. They're here because we're here. Frankly, if we weren't here, they wouldn't be. That might change as the cluster becomes the biggest thing here. I think the view on the balance of this will start to vary. But at the moment, my assessment is that they're still here largely because we are. Then there's a whole bunch of SMEs in the middle. They're partly here because we're here, but they're actually here because the supply community's here and other SMEs in a similar state in their business to themselves are here. And actually, I see quite a lot of cross-fertilization going on between the SMEs and between the SMEs and the supply community. And one or two of them are working with us. They've got products that we've scouted in the same way that we would scout innovations out in Silicon Valley or in Israel or in China. We scout them in the UK, and one location obviously to look is at Astral Park because it's right next door. And then the third tier would be the startups, so the people who we've got either in the incubator or the accelerator, who probably are a bit early for us, so we're keen to support them, to take them to a successful business operation. We actually engage with them to make sure that they are progressing in alignment with their own business plans, and we'll provide them advice and support as necessary. Typically we wouldn't be looking to those in that part of their business cycle to be working with BT and expect them to be providing big core technology to us. But the others, yes, and the big boys, yes, clearly. So we're working with, you know, the second biggest partner here at the park is Huawei, and clearly we work quite deeply with Huawei on a lot of technical stuff.
When we were talking earlier before the podcast, we were talking about the different models for startups. You've seen the universities come in, they've offered accommodation, some technical assistance, but they want a chunk of the company, and as a result, we know a lot of startups get themselves in a mess by the time they actually go to IPO. The founders own, well, maybe a coffee table in the corner. You were saying you have a much more philanthropic approach here. Can you just explain a bit more about that?
Yes, it's a pretty straightforward deal for anybody who has a good idea. If they want to be considered as part of the incubator or join the incubator, we ask them to come and present their business plan. So what is the technical core of their idea? How does it plan out? What business do they expect from it? And how do they expect to finance themselves? And if we like their business plan and we think it's technology that's in the right style for the cluster, because we don't accept any company, it has to be in the ICT sector, we will offer them a place in the incubator for up to 18 months. It's free of charge, so they get their comms, they get their accommodation, heating, lighting, all of that just comes free. They get a serviced office they can use. We take no interest in their business, apart from a sort of, oh, how's it going? Can we connect you to people who can provide finance? Can we connect you to other people in the cluster? So we take an active sort of development role, but we don't take a share in their business. So at the end of it, they've got no complications with BT. They're free to leave if they don't want to be here. But of course, our hope and our plan is that they will become successful, they will continue as the cluster, and it's a way of growing the cluster with new and exciting businesses.
So have there been any examples where you've had these companies grow up and then you've acquired them because their technology offers you something different?
We've not acquired any. We're a slow company to make acquisition decisions. We do make a few, and there's been a few big ones like EE. That was obvious. People noticed that one go through. But generally, we're slow to do that. With startups, typically, and with SMEs, we have liked working through some of the larger supply companies just as a way of working, keeping our processes simpler. But we will work with the small ones. We haven't bought any, certainly none coming out of Innovation Martlesham yet.
How much space do you have to keep expanding that? I look around this estate from the air, and it looks like there's a lot of space, but actually the number of people you've actually got here on the BT's banner, then all these partners coming in here, space must be starting to become a bit of a premium.
Yeah, so I'm humming and hawing now. That's an interesting question, actually. We've got to the point where the space that we've allocated to Innovation Martlesham, which, broadly speaking, four buildings at the park, are full. But we have other buildings that BT is still in that we are actually slowly but surely backing out of. Our need for space has been changing. The way that we run our labs, often by moving kit into data centres, so there's a much higher density of kit. So the need for kit and people to be alongside each other has changed over the years. That is still changing, that is still true. So there's some way to go yet before I run out of space, but I just need to do a bit of shuffling. So not a fundamental problem. I will be creating more space. In fact, we are right in the process now of freeing up quite a lot of space to get new companies in. So we're still growing.
What does that put pressure on you, oddly enough, in terms of telecoms and power? Because, of course, as you expand, you need more power. You also need more telecom capacity. And as most companies will attest, whenever they turn around and say, we need more telecoms capacity, oh, it's going to be 3 months or 6 months, you have a slight edge.
We don't. I'd love to say we do, but we don't. We don't. We suffer with all of the same lead times for provision as any other company or any other science park. So it is the same interface into Openreach with all of the same standing in line waiting for your service to be deployed. So that has been, well, it's been clear to see that we treat everybody equally. I have no advantage. I can offer no advantage. That does surprise people who join us, and I would love us to be the best and most well-connected site on the planet, but we're just the same as everybody else. With power, that's also an interesting question. We did get to the point where, because we are a power-hungry company, we consume very nearly 1% of the UK's power budget. We are, I think, probably the single biggest power consumer, actually. So it's a big issue for us, partly because it's big money. We have to hand over a large chunk of cash to use all that power. And here at the park, we're no different. So we did get to the point where we were just beginning to exceed the supply capability. That drove us to think quite carefully about how we manage power, how we use it. We went through a huge program of power reduction, turning off kit here that we didn't actually need on anymore, changing to low energy kit, whether it be screens or light bulbs. We've made a massive inroad into our energy consumption. I think we've taken it down from something around 14 megawatts to about 9 at the moment. So we've been going down rather than up, despite the fact that our business has been growing, the number of companies here have been growing. We've also taken a really interesting ecological direction as well. We now have access to Europe's largest private solar farm. It's providing 9 megawatts to the park, which you'll notice is the amount we need. Although when you do the sums on a yearly basis, it gives you 9 megawatts on a nice sunny day in the summer. But of course, as soon as the evening arrives, it gives you nothing. So we still need that supply from the generating boards. But we are capable of being self-sufficient for a few days in the year. And it knocks about 10% of our energy requirements off the mains and onto the solar farm. So quite an interesting piece of technology.
That reduction of power consumption becomes critical throughout the whole of BT and your wider estate, because as you roll out more boxes, you roll out more equipment into the old exchanges, you have to start thinking about the power they consume, keep that down, keep that under control. How much are you now feeding back into the wider BT environment of, hey, we've had to do this because we were forced to, this is what we've learned, these are the lessons we need to take into the field?
So about 6 years ago, it became a research topic, and we needed an energy model for business because we didn't have 2020 vision on where all of the energy was being consumed. We do now, and with the benefit of that insight, we have been slowly but surely reducing our energy consumption right across the estate. I think we're one of the few telcos that for the last 6 years has reduced its energy by about 3% per annum, despite growing our business, despite taking on more tech. And of course, we inherit a lot of our customers' tech that comes to us, that goes into our power budget, but nevertheless we are still reducing year on year. So it's a massive focus for us, and it won't stop. We're after that one pretty much continuously.
As we look forward over the next couple of years, what's exciting you about the industry?
Oh, well, where to begin? So all of the onward going sort of standards of the industry around faster speeds, more bandwidth to consumers, more speed in the core network, higher security. Security's got to be a big one, actually, and a lot of today is about sort of defence, but security plays into that. Those are all givens and they carry on. I think the new one, the one for me that's the one to watch, is exactly what happens with the Internet of Things. So this is the instrumentation of society. We're much farther down the road than anybody gives it credit for, yet we haven't really worked out what we do with it. We've got a number of global players that would love to have stovepipes and ecosystems that lock people in. Our philosophy is very different. We'd like to have a very open platform, so all of the sensors, all of the available data can be accessed by anybody who has a good idea. And I think this is going to be one of the transformational steps in the next 5 years, probably, where we start to see everything being managed differently from national government, local government, healthcare, transport, probably education, through into the home, the way that people run that. So everything is up for grabs once you start to instrument and gather data. But what I don't think the industry's worked out yet is exactly how we put that together in a way that is valuable to everybody, and how do we avoid stovepipes becoming the order of the day, so that in fact we shackle ourselves into a lesser set of services. If we take a very open view, we're going to get a very rich set of things that we can do differently. So that is probably the one that I'm most excited about.
Security is one of the big challenges with Internet of Things. If we go back 10, 15 years and think about Wi-Fi routers, they came out, they were easily hacked, they came out with a default admin password, it was in the books, and then the industry got together under a bit of pressure from government regulators, and now when it arrives, it comes with multiple passwords, multiple accounts, all complex names, all designed to add security. We've yet to see any pressure around that in terms of Internet of Things. Do you think that there's a point where telcos in general need to engage more with these companies for what's being moved across to identify big areas of insecurity? And is there a point where the regulators need to learn the lesson from what we did with Wi-Fi routers and say, okay, you need to build this in from scratch. It cannot just be something that arrives over a period of time.
I'm tempted to just say yes. That's not a very helpful answer for you, but pretty much what you've just laid out, I agree with. Possibly, I think we've begun to see how it can be a problem. I think we have seen some early denial of service attacks coming from IoT devices, so we know we need a pretty robust layer of, an appropriate layer of security around them. Many of the sensors are going to be cheap devices because we want to sprinkle them around the environment, so they can't be super expensive, but they need to be secure, they need to be unhackable, so they can only do the thing that they've been purposed to do. I don't think we've fully got our heads around that. That is part of our interest. We are working on that as part of our research program. How do we make sure that we bring security not just to the devices themselves, but to the services that sit behind those devices? So we would take a view that you need security at all levels in the network, whether it's down at the optical layer when we were talking about quantum key distribution, or up at the apps layer, whether that's sitting in a server somewhere in the cloud, or whether it's out on a sensor sitting in the network just monitoring road traffic movement, for example. viable. I think we would say we'd need security at every layer. Whether it's something the regulator needs to get involved with, I don't really have a view on. My thoughts are it's such an important topic for the industry that the industry will sort it out. By the time the regulator says you need to do it, you've sort of rather missed the boat, and I don't think we can afford to do that.
One of the challenges of Internet of Things is going to be bandwidth. Bandwidth is a challenge wherever you are. As the pressure grows across both fixed and mobile networks with Internet of Things, how fast can we begin to scale those networks in order to cope with the expected traffic levels?
That's an interesting question. Of course, access to broadband is a hot topic anyway, and BT's busily rolling out broadband as deeply as it can to the population as quickly as it can. We also now have EE as part of the BT family, and EE is busy rolling out 4G. We've got pretty good coverage on 4G, and we've got a commitment through the emergency services network to get it to something like 98% of geographical coverage. There's going to be pretty universally adequate coverage for what most people are trying to do. The Internet of Things doesn't necessarily require high bandwidth, because a lot of it could be low bandwidth reporting back of regular heartbeat pieces of data, road temperature. You don't need a lot of bandwidth to carry a 15-minute feedback on what's the road temperature. So I think it's a bit of a mixed economy on bandwidth. We're going to be deploying it through mobile. We're going to be deploying it through copper. We are working pretty hard on 5G, which of course is a mobile technology. Actually, I think it's going to be a pretty hybrid technology with a clear intention of offering better coverage, better speeds. It's the direction of travel for the industry, so I think the Internet of Things is not the problem for bandwidth, certainly not yet, anyway.
We've seen Norway turn off FM and free up that whole spectrum for use for broadband and for other technologies. The UK government's also considering the same idea. Are we ready for that yet? Can we grab that and take it? Or is there a risk, as we've seen with 3G, 4G, 5G, where the government will just see this as a cash cow rather than an enabler?
That's a very interesting question. I suspect we as an industry would be happy to respond to the opportunity of using the bandwidth that would be made available. I think this is more a question of whether the UK has actually managed to land digital radio as a ubiquitous service. Certainly this morning as I was waking up, I normally have the radio on, it is a digital radio, it wasn't working, and so I'm lying in bed thinking this is not good. I'm just not convinced that we've won the hearts and minds question yet, so I'd be surprised to see them do it in the short term future. I don't think the country's been taken far enough down the digital route yet, but that's a personal view. I don't really have a business based view on what the government's likely to do on digital radio.
Kevin, thank you for your time this morning.
You're very welcome.